So Brooks Richards, Reel 3. Specialist pilotage service, which the French Navy ran, whereby one of these specially trained pilotes de la flotte formed part of the crew of all ships from destroyer upwards in the French Navy. And they learnt their business of getting in and out of French ports by going round in the Mutin and a sister ship, in and out of all these harbours until they really knew them extremely well and were fully qualified. Well, the Mutin, having turned up in England, she was better built and in better condition than any of the sailing tunnymen, and Holdsworth laid hands on her. But he'd been told he could have a sum of £1,000 to fit out his two fishing boats, and he could pick a crew of 12 ratings from the Royal Naval Patrol Service depot at Lowestoft, most of whom were peacetime fishermen, but that he wasn't to come back until he'd had asked for any more money, though his crew would be paid, and he could draw naval rations for them, and he could put them in any clothes he wanted. He wasn't to come back and ask for any more money until he'd actually demonstrated that his ideas were sound and workable. So he started off by having the Mutin fitted out at a yacht yard, Phillips yacht yard in Dartmouth, and most of the £1,000 was absorbed by fitting her out alone. And by which hangs a rather funny tale. The crew that he'd assembled, the first man to join him was a very colourful character called John Louis Newton, who was from Guernsey, from St. Peter Port in Guernsey, who was a peacetime inshore fisherman and part-time smuggler. And I think he had not only been in trouble with the authorities, but he'd actually been to jail for it, though he was rather coy about this. But the interesting thing is, in 1940, at the collapse of France, when the Channel Islanders were faced with being cut off from England and occupied by the Germans, they organised a committee under Lord Portsea's chairmanship to decide what should be done to keep themselves alive, because they produced very little except tomatoes. And they decided that clandestine shipments of food would be essential. And they decided that the only man who had the daring and skill and knowledge of the waters to ship such consignments ashore clandestinely under enemy occupation was John Newton of St. Peter Port, smuggler and rogue though he might be. And so they sent a telegram to the Admiralty, this is all before the occupation by the Germans had taken place, saying that they must at all costs have John Louis Newton found and sent to them, and he was believed to be serving in the Royal Navy. Well, this signal ended in Naval Intelligence Department in the hands of Peter Fleming of James Bond fame, and he looked through all the Navy lists, and there was no officer called John Louis Newton. And it took some weeks before finally they tracked down a leading seaman of that name serving in Scarpa Flow. And he was ordered to London, where he was interviewed by Peter Fleming, by Ian Fleming, sorry. Did I say Peter before? Ian, I mean. He decided that really he ought not to be returned to general service. He was too potentially useful a man. So he was put on one side, and in due course presented to Holdsworth as his first rating, as a member of his crew. And the second man to join Holdsworth was man called Tom Long, whom I've recommended to the museum. Newton is dead, but Long is living in King's Lynn and very much alive. Long had been, before the war, deckhand in on, I think, a coastal barge of some sort, or in any rate, some form of small coaster. And he was a Royal Naval Reservist, but he was quite familiar with a number of continental ports to which they traded regularly. And though he was in 1940, was serving in a destroyer, I think one of the tribal class destroyers, Cossack, perhaps. But he had a rather intelligent divisional officer who was very interested in in Tom Long's pre-war knowledge, and recommended him through proper naval channels as somebody who might be of value for special operations. So Tom Long appeared as Jerry Holdsworth's second crew member. And when they went to take delivery of the Mutin from Dartmouth and put to sea, they were still very short of gear and equipment, and they ran into bad weather and had to, instead of going straight to Falmouth, they had to go to Brixham, where they tied up alongside a Brixham sailing trawler, such as had been used right up to the war, but in wartime conditions, I suppose, weren't thought worthwhile trying to operate. And John Newton quickly decided that this laid-up Brixham trawler had far more chain cable on board than she needed. So at night, having told Holdsworth what he was going to do, no doubt, he got the engineman on board, who was a reprobate character from Arbroath called Jock Grubb, whom Holdsworth had recruited at Lowestoft, but whom I previously had encountered at Ardrossan after he had managed to sink the vessel of the same class as my Sèvres, in which he was serving, by getting drunk and opening a seacock. He was marched off and put into jail, into naval glasshouse. So almost as soon as he came out, he was recruited by Holdsworth as his engineman. At any rate, he got a bagpipe, and he was very good at keeping an engine running in adverse conditions. And Jock Grubb was put to play the bagpipe, and they conducted the rather noisy operation of stealing 15 fathoms of chain from this Brixham trawler. And next day, they were still lying in harbour, and the owner of the trawler came down and noticed a lot of rust about on the deck, and had a look and came to the conclusion that they'd stolen most of his chain cable. So he went and complained to the police, and the police came down and wanted to come on board the Mutin. John Newton, who was in charge in Holdsworth's absence, said, no, no, he'd have to have the captain's permission before he could do that. And the police hadn't managed to get on board by the time night fell, when a reverse operation had to be mounted, with Grubb playing the bagpipe once again and the train being put back where it had come from. And so next day, when the police came down with the indignant owner of the trawler, went back on board, there was nothing found missing whatever. But I tell this silly little story because the whole thing was really, the whole Helford operation was mounted on such slender resources that pinching a piece of equipment like that was a necessary part of the whole thing at the time, I've no doubt. And John Newton was very light-handed, very good at pinching fowls, which were most welcome, MSA's variant to the naval diet. But he was always a rogue, and he needed to be kept under fairly firm control, which was fine as long as Holdsworth was around. Well, Holdsworth had therefore collected the Mutin, and he picked up, in fact, two other French fishing vessels. One, the Denise Louise, which came from Honfleur, I think, and another, the Serenini, from Fécamp. And he'd also got a very large West Coast Camaret crabber called the Triboulist. Now, she probably would have come from Triboul, therefore, which is just next door to Douarnenez. But she was a class of vessel that they called the Mauritania, that fished for shellfish down the coast of Morocco in the autumn and went across to the West Indies to Fort de France in the spring. So a quite large vessel. And there was no money to fit her out. He thought she might come in useful at some later time. No money to fit out Serenini. But he did have this collection of vessels at Helford in the summer of 1941. But unfortunately, the Denise Louise was a North Coast type of vessel, which I would not have actually chosen myself for operations on the West Coast, which turned out to be where we had to operate. He had also collected from the RAF a 41-foot-6 seaplane tender with the bearing the number 360, which they'd given him in the hope that he would be able to bring back RAF pilots, because the recuperation of shot-down pilots, escapers and evaders, was already very much a preoccupation of theirs at the time, a shortage of pilots being what it was. And 360, as is recorded in the French book I've referred to, but not mentioned at all in Hampshire. Indeed, Holdsworth gets no mention in Hampshire at all. 360 had... she was really intended for servicing flying boats in harbour. But she had, in fact, enough tankage to do about 100 miles, which is the distance across to the coast at the western end of the channel. But, of course, she needed to be refueled when she got down there to come back. So, to take her across the channel, you had to carry a lot of cans of diesel fuel to fill up the tanks before you made the return journey. Well, now, I joined Holdsworth in July 1941, having been summoned down from the North Sea, where I was minesweeping, and called in to NID, where they said, did you write this paper recommending use of fishing boats, come and go to France? I said, yes, indeed I did. And they said, well, what do you know about Brittany? And I told them. And they then said, well, would you volunteer for this type of service? And I said, of course I would. And they said, well, in that case, we must warn you that they're very slender resources, but you'll be working with a chap whom you must now meet called Holdsworth, and with somebody you know already very well, Bill Luard. And I was then put in... They appeared, we met, and I went down to Helford. And at Helford, Holdsworth was attempting at that stage, well, was carrying out the fitting out of the Mutin to enable her to pass as a tunnyman. Because the Breton tunny fleet, contrary to what is said in Hampshire, was fishing under sail in 1940, going off to the Mont La Chapelle, which is roughly west of Brest, southwest of Brest, and on the edge of the continental shelf. They were making quite long excursions. They might be out a fortnight or 3 weeks, and most of them had no motors. They were a very picturesque sight at the time because you can't catch Tunny at a speed of less than about 4 or 4.5 knots because you have to catch them on an unbarbed hook. And the gear is very complicated. They have 8 lines each side of the ship suspended from long rods that are lured from the mast outboard, outwards, and then they have 2 lines over the stern and one from the mizzen masthead. So in all, 19 lines probably in all. And of course no one in England knew how to rig this stuff. And fortunately, at that stage, SOE French section in London, F section, had as number two Thomas Cadet, who'd been the Times correspondent in Paris before the war and was subsequently the BBC correspondent in Paris and became a friend of mine. Tom Cadet met in a pub a French fisherman called Pierre Guillet, G-U-I-L-L-E-T, from Noirmoutier, who was in London in the middle of the bombing, having been picked up from his Tunnyman in the Bay of Biscay by a British submarine or destroyer, I can't vouch for the craft, who brought him back to Plymouth, where he was interrogated about German coastal defences, of which there were very few at Noirmoutier at the time. And he was then really turned adrift with 25 shillings a week to keep himself fed, a free Frenchman, malgré lui, in England, and went to London and was found lodgings with a working class family somewhere in Clerkenwell, I think. As he couldn't find red wine he liked drinking, he had to take to beer and was found in a pub when Thomas Cadet ran into him. Cadet realized, knowing that Holdsworth had got hold of a Tunnyman and was trying to fit her out, that Guillet was the perfect man to advise him and help him. So Guillet was approached and he said he would go down to Cornwall and would advise us. And he came with a false identity, having grown a beard so he wouldn't be recognized. And he was called Monsieur Pierre. And of course was a civilian at the time. And it was just at this point that I had appeared down there, and I was responsible really for the fitting out of the rods, yards and gear with Guillet, and he was absolutely splendid, gave us all the information we needed, showed us how to do it all. And Holdsworth had also found a field security policeman called George Peake, who had been a salesman in Brittany before the war for a British engineering firm at Bridport, who sold line hauling gear to Breton line fishermen, particularly in the Douarnenez area. George Peake, therefore, had quite a wide knowledge of French fishing industry, and he turned up at Helford as one of Holdsworth's men. And he found, somewhere down at Newlyn, a prototype Tunny hook, which is fairly large, a pair of hooks like that, which have no barb and is made visible to the fish by having some brightly coloured horsehair attached just above the hook to the line. So they'll make a dash for this. They're voracious feeders, the the Tongeremon, which is the commercial tunny, which is quite sizable fish, but not the giant that you get when sport fishing, and which, of course, can weigh hundreds of pounds. But the lack of barbs is because the fishing is so fast and furious that you want to get the fish off the hook. But of course, it means you've got to be proceeding at a fair speed, otherwise the fish simply slips off the hook as soon as it strikes. And when we'd worked out and rigged this gear, old Pierre Guillet said to me, "I don't know what you're going to do with all this, but I'm volunteer to come with you." So we got him put into naval uniform as a chief petty officer in the Royal Naval Reserve, and he turned out to be absolutely invaluable because he not only had been a fisherman, but he'd previously been in the captain in charge of a coaster, and he knew all the north coast of Brittany extremely well. And his pilotage knowledge was really without any equal in Great Britain at that time. And anyhow, this was put to a test very early on because towards the end of August 1941, Holdsworth and I were sent off with 360 to a rendezvous with a French fishing boat at one of the sea marks just to the west of the Morley River. And we crossed the channel on a bright moonlight night so we could actually see what we were doing. It may sound a crazy thing because obviously the boat showed up as well, but at that time there really seemed to be no alternative. There were no lights on the coast, except when a convoy was passing. The boys were out, and consequently, coming down on that unlighted coast, which it's extremely rocky, dangerous, and very strong tides, was really quite a navigational problem. And one had to find one's rendezvous really in the 360 with nothing except a log and an echo sounder. And you get a fairly good eye check on your log by crossing the Herd Deep, which is a deep trench running west from the Cherbourg Peninsula, if you were in the right part of the channel, and it runs fairly far west. But after that, you'd really be forced to slow down in order that your engines wouldn't be audible. And you'd probably have to contend with a socking tide of, which might be anything up to 6 knots, setting you sideways. So you approach the coast very much like a crab, at a speed of probably no more than 8 or 9 knots at the most. And we made our rendezvous perfectly successfully with this first operation. And there at the appointed hour, at the appointed place, was a very small boat that had been brought down the river on the ebb tide by an old man who had for other crew only a boy. And the boat, though normally it would have hoisted sail, couldn't obviously on this occasion because of wishing to come down as quietly as possible under the noses of German sentries. I presume he'd come down, in fact, before moonrise. We chose nights rather deliberately so that though we would have the benefit of moon on arrival on the coast, we would hope to get it silhouetting something that we could recognize as it rose. And so a night with a moonrise about 11 o'clock at night in those early days was very valuable and what one most would choose. And at any rate, the moon was extremely bright that night, and Pierre Guillet knew exactly where he was when we came into the coast. He recognized the Ile de Bar and its lighthouse, and we found the Trépied, which is where we were going. We collected a parcel off the old man, which was the courier of an intelligence organization, a Polish one. And the first thing that was done was to rush below, Holdsworth took it below and opened it up to see whether it contained a bomb or anything of the sort. It was all right. I was greatly surprised by his reflex, but he was absolutely right. But meanwhile, of course, poor old man had been kept covered by guns, and he was allowed to go. And it wasn't till I was given Hugon's book years later that I realized the identity of the man. He was Jacques Guégan, then aged 70, who had been one of Charcot's sailors on the Pourquoi Pas on his Antarctic expedition in 1912, and who, as I earlier said, had brought out various parties of British soldiers in June 1940, gone back, and the Germans had, as I now know, already chucked him into jail in January 1941, and he got out after a month because they couldn't find any conclusive evidence against him. I learned this only from a lady named Madame Le Duc, who figures extensively in the Hugon book, wife of a doctor at Morlaix, whom I met years and years later when I went there for David Birkin to be decorated by President Mitterrand, to whom I'd arranged for him to be introduced during a state visit, because David Birkin had been with the 15th motor gunboat flotilla that brought Mitterrand back to France in March 44, long after I'd gone to the Mediterranean. And I thought Mitterrand would be interested to meet him. Mitterrand was so interested that he gave him the Légion d'honneur, and I was invited over to see it pinned on. And I met Madame Le Duc, and she said, "Oh, yes, you're quite right about that being Guégan. But we destroyed all the things that might have been embarrassing to Guégan, and we went outside the jail in Morlaix, and we shouted in Breton to him that we destroyed everything, and he didn't need to fear or confess to anything." And, of course, the Germans couldn't understand the Breton. So Guégan was released, but impenitently continued working for an intelligence group, and was bringing, this was one of the early Polish groups, because the Poles did leave people behind, one of their F1 or F2 groups, I think, working for SIS at that time and the Poles, and perfectly willing to